Well, good evening and welcome back, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That brief cut opening tonight's show is Sacred Alchemy by Diva Haley on her CD of the same name. I want to say thanks again to Jane for sending in this quote of Isaac Asimov, seemed appropriate for the show. Isaac said, and I quote, "Anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge," unquote. So true, isn't it? I'm thinking trickle-down economics, denial of climate change, the insane belief women can't get pregnant if they're really raped, our country allowing itself to be lied into a bogus war, and on, not to mention the fact that there was a time on this planet when women were not commodities or dominated and exploited by men. Well, that's what passes for normal today, but many feminist scholars believe they can offer proof to the contrary, no matter how hard academia or patriarchy try to discredit them. And we're going to see to it that that changes too. We have a new normal in mind, and it's not a normal that involves anti-intellectualism or exploitation. And what are men in patriarchal religions so afraid of after all? Matthew Fox spoke with me last week about their fear of the chaos of nature, and by association, that chaos of the sacred feminine and women. I'd like someone to translate this irrational fear to me. Explain in rational terms how giving women equality and respect will unravel society. Are men afraid the tables will be turned and they'll suddenly be marginalized? That they'll have to pay us equal pay for equal work? That we'll not let them dictate what we can or can't do with our bodies? That we won't settle for doing 80% of the work and only receive 20% of the assets? Yes, this is that radical feminism the Vatican, the Taliban, and other extreme Christians hate. It's also called equal rights. Sad shame, isn't it? Well, this can't be sustained, nor will it be accepted much longer. Too many of us are finding our sacred roar, and we don't want patriarchy in a skirt either. We'll be fair. We don't want to dominate men. We just want an equal partnership with equal representation in government, academia, corporate America, and religious institutions. Well, be sure you tune in next week. I'm really excited to have coming on the show June 5th, the famous Noam Chomsky. Yes, indeed, I am thrilled about that. Lane Redman will be on the show after my chat with Noam discussing her new priestess program that's about to start. Starhawk is also coming on in July to discuss her upcoming film, The Fifth Sacred Thing. And tonight we have two great guests. First up is the Rabbi Wayne Dosick talking to us about his book, The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine. And yes, yes, don't worry, I've gotten your emails. I'm going to ask him where the sacred feminine fits into his paradigm, why the Torah says to men, be glad they are not born women, and why, if the Kabbalah feels women are spiritually superior, why it's men at the front of the temple channeling the light. Then after, we speak to the rabbi, a true hero to women and men who value equality, justice, and human dignity. Returning to the show is Father Roy Bourgeois. If you don't know him, you'll want to know him and his story. A Mary Knoll priest for 45 years, Father Roy would not recant his position that women, like men, hear God's call to the priesthood. And for that courageous statement, which he refused to recant, he paid the ultimate price. Excommunication by the Vatican under the guidance of the former Pope Ratzinger, who last week's guests, Matthew Fox, another excommunicated priest, said will be known for bringing back the Inquisition to the Church. Well, Father Roy is giving interviews again after learning of the Church's position in his situation last November. We'll check in with him, see how he's doing, learn about the woman priest movement he supports, and get his insights on this new pope and how it can possibly be that the Vatican will protect priests who molest children, but standing for women's equality is an offense that brings excommunication. Wow. But first, a bit of housekeeping, a word from Joe Carson and Dancing with Gaia.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth. Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected. They were together, that there wasn't a separation. That's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. it gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want. Sex is sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
That was some sounds from the trailer for the DVD Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about Earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of Goddess as Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film, and you can get it or find more about it at the website Dancing with Gaia. .com. I do public service announcements here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, as well as paid commercials to help defray the cost of airtime, because we do not have a sponsor, which we are looking for. And if you can contribute to help me pay for airtime, that would be fantastic. Remember, Gaia teaches us what we care for and nurture thrives, what we neglect withers. You can make a contribution to the cost of airtime by going to my webpage at KarenTate.com. When you're there, check out the Goddess store, scroll down to the bottom, see the PayPal button, make a donation of any amount. It's all welcome, and small contributions, well, you know they add up. And while you're there, check out the free stuff you'll find throughout my page, meditations, articles, classes, talks on my YouTube channel. So, all of that out of the way, let me say hello and introduce my first guest by way of his bio, the Rabbi Wayne Dosick. He is a revered educator, writer, spiritual guide, and healer who teaches and counsels about faith, ethical values, life transformations, and evolving human consciousness, and is well known for his quality scholarship and sacred spirit. He's been described as a rational intellect with the soul of a mystic. And in connection with his new book, The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine, he's been called a spiritual master of our time. And that's what we're mostly going to talk about tonight. The rabbi is the award-winning author of 8 previous critically acclaimed books, the now classic Living Judaism, Golden Rules, Soul Judaism, When Life Hurts, The Business Bible, The Best Is Yet to Be, and with his wife, Ellen Kaufman Dosick, 20-Minute Kabbalah, and Empowering Your Indigo Child. For more than 17 years, he served as visiting adjunct professor at the University of San Diego, teaching the only courses in Jewish studies at this Catholic university. And currently, he's the spiritual guide of the Elijah Minyan in San Diego and the host of the internet show Spirit Talk Live. He's here today to share his revolutionary revelation of the real name of God and to invite people into a deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship with the divine. So welcome to the show, Rabbi.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Just a slight correction, and this is as I look for names. So my last name is pronounced Dosick. It looks like Dosick in spelling, but it's pronounced Dosick. So I'm happy to be here, and can you imagine what they used to call me in gym class in high school?
Well, thank you for that correction. I appreciate it. I hadn't actually heard your last name pronounced before. So, as I mentioned before we, you know, went on the air, before we get to your book, I want to get a few questions out of the way, because I did take some Kabbalah classes here in Los Angeles, and it left me with some lingering questions that were never adequately answered. And so please, you know, I'm here to teach and I'm here to learn, so don't be shy about telling me what I've gotten wrong, because I don't want to go through life misunderstanding. First, Rabbi, let me ask you if you can please explain. In Kabbalah, one of the things that attracted me to it, one of the reasons I thought, well, let me study this a little bit, was because they do have the sacred feminine as a paradigm there. They have the Shekinah. We heard, through books like, for instance, from people like, say, Karen Berg, for instance. I don't know if this is across the board Kabbalah teachings, but that the feminine women are actually more spiritually superior than men. But that didn't really sort of seem like it was in sync with the teachings in the Torah that say, you know, be glad, telling men to be glad they aren't born a woman. Can you kind of explain the thinking there? Where is the confusion?
Well, it's like trying to enter the sea between here and China and explain every water molecule in 20 minutes. Nevertheless, it somehow goes like this. First of all, just one correction. It doesn't say in the Torah that the men should be thankful they're superior to women. That's in the later prayer book. Look,
okay.
Judaism came to be in a very patriarchal time. The feminine has been hidden away since the Garden of Eden. So when Adam and Eve disobeyed the original command, the original injunction in Eden to not eat of the fruit of the tree, that was the moment when we fell from 5D to 3D. That was the moment when the masculine and the feminine Godhead split. And the masculine took dominance. The feminine went into exile with Adam and Eve and has been pushed underground for the entire history of Judaism, as well as the history of most other Western religions. Christianity, Islam. The Kabbalists came along in the 13th century and they said there is the divine feminine within Judaism. We have hints of it early in some of the names of God, but they brought back the notion of Shekhinah, of the divine feminine, but still the divine feminine and divine masculine were split. What the Kabbalists were trying to do was form a synthesis. Now, I have to jump into my new book, The Real Name of God, because the basic premise is that all of the names that we have for God, all of the names, and there are hundreds, thousands of names for God, not one of them is God's real name. Each one of them is one aspect or attribute or characteristic or behavior or manifestation of God. So if you picture a beach ball, a colored beach ball, with its many different colored panels, each one of the colored panels is one of the names of God, representing only one of the aspects of the divine. My question was, what's the name of the whole beach ball? And could I go back into the Bible itself and hide and find it hiding in plain sight all these years, just waiting for the right energetic moment in time to be revealed? And I found it. And in that discovery, I find, of course, that God is the everything of the everything. There is nothing in this world that is not of God. And so God is both masculine and feminine, right and wrong, good and evil, light and dark and shadow, justice and mercy. And so one of the main issues of this discovery, of this revelation, is the awareness that God is everything and each of us is everything because we're created in the image and the reflection of God. And so within each of us is the masculine and the feminine. Jung understood it when he talked about the archetypes about some 100 years ago or so. So
right,
this
right.
is why this discovery... One of the reasons why this discovery is at this moment in time, because we have come to the moment in time when, if we are to have oneness, if we are to have oneness consciousness, we can no longer have this split between masculine and feminine. We have to have the grading of masculine and feminine. And it's happening in the heavens right now, and it's being reflected on Earth right now. I mean, I'm sure you know this better than anybody, but Ms. Magazine, the first issue was 1972. The first woman rabbi was ordained in 1973. Everything that's happened with the feminist movement has happened in the last 40, 50 years, which is the very time that this discovery was getting ready to bubble up and come into the world. And so we are reflecting on Earth what is happening in the heavens right now. So the reason the men have dominated is that men are patriarchal, and they think that the power, men think that the power is in their hands. What we're finding out now is that unless it is shared, unless the world is shared in equality, we will not be able to move on to 5D consciousness and bring Eden to Earth once again.
Well, when I invited you on the show, I suspected you would say as much. So thank you for that, Rabbi. And you know,
I do want to add in this context that, you know, back in men build ladders. Men build linear ladders. The old corporate ladder and the man in the gray flannel suit. You start out as the mail clerk and you hopefully wind up as the CEO. Women weave networks and webs.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened in this world, to be reflective of this, we now have the egalitarian, it's called not the worldwide ladder, but it's called the worldwide internet and the worldwide web, reflective of the egalitarianism that is coming into the world in order to move us from the place that we have been to the place where we are going.
Well, you are definitely speaking our language. It's as if you picked up our dictionary and you've gotten all of our definitions and our ideals just right. So you're on our side. But
well,
I was in the class
behind. We went to undergraduate school together, but I was in the rabbinic class behind the first woman rabbi, Rabbi Sally
Priestman.
And she was ordained in 72, I was ordained in 73, and at one time she invited me to be a scholar in residence in her synagogue before she retired in New Jersey. And I stood on her pulpit and I publicly begged her forgiveness because we the students were all very, very supportive of her. And yet we stood silent as some of the professors were obnoxious and horrible to her, and we didn't stand up for her to them. So even though we were personally supportive and we adore her, I ask public forgiveness for the male students at that time who did not stand up to the professors who were making her life miserable.
Good for you. So then is it safe to assume that when someone brings that quote from the prayer book that I mentioned, you know, that, you know, men should be glad not to be born a woman, do you make a correction? Do you explain why it's, you know, why that was maybe okay for a time, or maybe it really was never okay, but why is it especially not okay now?
Well, of course I do. And actually the prayer book that I grew up with and that I use, which was published back in 1945, already took that line out and replaced it.
Okay.
So there it says, "Who made me according to your will." Now,
okay.
There are, you know, we have to say there are different roles for men and women. I myself have never been able to give birth to a child.
True.
Right? I fathered a child. But so there are different roles. And it's one of the things about the oneness consciousness that we are coming to. Oneness does not mean sameness.
Mm-hmm.
Oneness consciousness means that we know we are all children of the one God, that we know that in order for this world to flourish, we have to stop fighting with each other and yelling, "My God's better than your God," and
right.
all that is going on. But oneness is not sameness. One of my closest, dearest friends in the entire world is a Jesuit priest. He doesn't want me to be Catholic, and I don't want him to be Jewish. We know that we come from the same place, and we're going to the same place. We serve God, but we build different pathways. And I honor and respect his pathway. He honors and respects mine. So there is beauty in difference as well.
Absolutely, diversity. The feminine face of God is the poster girl for diversity. But
yeah.
let me just ask you this, because you know I want to have some understanding and closure on a few of these things before we, you know, talk more in depth about your book. I'm wondering if it was unique to the classes I took here in Los Angeles on Kabbalah, when they said that you know, Kabbalists believe that women are actually spiritually superior. That's why it's the men that are always saying the prayers. That's why it's the men at the front of the temple, you know, channeling the light. Somehow that seemed to, you know, to not sit well with me, because I thought, well, if you really do think the feminine is superior, why isn't it the woman at the front of the temple leading the prayers? You know, why isn't it the women also, you know, joining in with the prayers, and not just, you know, the women always sort of sat over to the side, visiting with one another, while the men on the other side of the room were all dressed in white and were dutifully doing their prayers. It struck me as very odd. And I don't know if, like I said, if it was unique to this group that I was at, or if it's, or if there's a reason for that, and it's typical of Kabbalah across the board.
Well, that's the Orthodox position within Judaism, as it is within Islam, as it is within fundamental Christianity as well. It's certainly not my position. I think that men say those things, and if there are Orthodox Jews listening to this, I will be flamed, as they say. But I think it's men trying to retain their own power. Oh, the woman is superior, so we'll continue to do our thing, and we'll have all the power. I think it is men afraid of their own sexuality. They say that women and men can't pray together because the men might be distracted by the beauty and the voice of the woman. So whose fault is that? Is that the woman's fault? Of course not. It's the man who can't deal with his own sexuality. I will tell you this. When I came to the synagogue that I first came to in San Diego in 1975, I was a young rabbi in those days, and they said to me in the interview, "Rabbi, what's your bottom line?" I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, for some it's keeping kosher, and for some it's observing the Sabbath, and for some it's this." I said, "My bottom line goes like this. This synagogue right now does not offer full equality to women. So during the term of my first contract, we will study and learn together. And at the end, near the end of that first contract, you will vote. After all, it's your synagogue. You will vote and give full religious equality to women. And then if you offer me a new contract, I'll stay. If you decide not to do that, even if you do offer me a new contract, I will leave." So my place in terms of equality for women, women leading the prayers, women taking full and equal part, has been there from the very, very beginning of my career.
Well, and you know what I found odd about it was, you know, they tried to tell me that, you know, they went back to this idea of roles, that, you know, that men, you know, I think part of the reason was, you know, English was their second language, Hebrew was their first, and maybe they couldn't always finesse what they were actually trying to say. Either that, or I just kept asking too many questions, too many different ways, and maybe, you know, I sort of made a nuisance of myself. But I couldn't understand, if they really thought the feminine was superior, you know, why, you know, of course they let the women teach, of course they let the women run the office, but it was always, you know, these old rabbis that, you know, they revered at the holidays all during the year, you know, with the exception of, I think, you know, one or two women, you never really heard much about the women. It felt like it was, you know, the talk was one thing, but the practice was something else. And they couldn't understand why I would get so annoyed with the fact that, or I couldn't understand why, you know, they didn't think women could channel the light. You know, why it had to be the men that channeled the light into the sanctuary. And they would say, well, it's the role of the man. Well, that didn't, you know, that just didn't sit well with me, because it, you know, it felt like, you know, why the church tells you need a priest at the head of the church. You know, you need this intermediary, you know, between you and the divine. And anyway, it made me wonder if they realized that they were appearing, at least, to be sexist, even if they thought in their heart they weren't.
No, I think it's, I'll repeat again, it's orthodoxy. It's fundamentalism of any kind of group, and it is men trying to rationalize away their consolidation of power, and so we'll keep the women pregnant and barefoot and in the kitchen, but we'll tell them they're superior to us.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, one of the ways you could get the most light was to have a child. So where did that leave women like me who just didn't want to do that this time around? But anyway, all right, let's leave that all aside. Let's get to your book, The Real Name of God. So you talked about the beach ball. I get that. So and within goddess spirituality, we have so many different goddesses. That makes total sense to me because certain goddesses, you know, are known to be the archetype for, you know, certain things. You know, some are warrioresses, some are muses, some are healers, some are mothers, blah, blah, blah. So it's the same exact thing, but if we're going to talk a literal name of God, I know over at the Kabbalah Center, they didn't ever want to use the name Yahweh. It was like a blasphemy to speak the word. In your understanding, you know, of the real name of God, what word would you use? What word would be his name or her name?
Let me just point out, in their defense, it wasn't blasphemy to speak the word the name of God. It was just so sacred that they didn't want to speak it.
Okay.
So here, the real name of God is Anochi. It's one of those words. If you have the Jewish, like Hanukkah and Challah, you get it. Otherwise, Johann Sebastian Bach. Anochi.
Okay.
So Anochi usually is translated as I, as in me. But Hebrew has another word for I, which is a small self, the ego self, the personal self. Anochi is the whole self, the totality, the completeness. It is used 359 times in the Bible. Every time it is in the voice of God, it is when no one individual characteristic or aspect of God will suffice, but the entirety of God is vital to the teaching or to the event. And it's also used in the voice of human beings when a human being says, how do I get in touch with the God within me? How do I touch my God self? How do I be as godlike as possible?
You know, I consider myself a recovering Catholic, so but it's been a while since, you know, I've studied any of this sort of stuff. But never have I heard that word at all in my Catholic upbringing.
Well, it's because it has simply been translated as I. But with this discovery that I've made, I now know that it is the name of God.
Okay. And you're spelling it?
A-N-O. In English, we transliterate A-N-O-C-H-I. A-N-O-C-H-I. And
okay.
So you will, I think it just occurred to me, I haven't spoken about this in any other interview, but because of your great interest in the feminine, you know, all the blessings, all the God language that we have is all in the masculine. It's masculine
mm-hmm.
God language, it's masculine grammar. Back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, women, or feminists actually, of both genders, began writing prayers, rewriting the prayers, in the feminine God language and in the feminine grammatical form. And it worked for a while, but the problem was that men felt as left out with feminine God language as women felt left out with male God language. So the great thing about Anochi is that it is a genderless word. In Hebrew words have gender, as in many, many languages, and this is a genderless word, so better it's a gender-full word, which means that it is the male and the female, the wholeness, the completeness, the everything of God. And so I rewrote the blessings that are in which I put in the book to address God in completely egalitarian way. So the blessing is, instead of saying King of the Universe, the blessing is, blessed is Anochi, the source of all worlds and the breath of every living thing.
Hmm. Lovely.
Now,
and the fact that it's also I, is that supposed to reference the idea that, you know, we are all part of the divine, part of the web, you know, a microcosm of the macrocosm sort of idea?
Exactly. When we talk about the everything, it means that God is in God, and God is in everything in this universe, including you and me and the orange and the elephant and the rock. It means
okay.
that we learn that God is both the transcendent God of creation and history, and God is the immanent God of breath and soul, the God who is within us, the God who animates us and gives us life, and this is the way we come in touch with our God self, with the God within.
Well, speaking of that, in the second part of your book, you have some skills and techniques for getting in touch with the God within, or
right.
as you call it, the God self. Do you want to tell us about some of those techniques?
Sure. We have poems and prayers and meditations and spiritual exercises. We also have 30 chants, C-H-A-N-T-S, songs in the book. And you can't hear a chant on paper and ink, so we put them all onto the website, www.godisanochi.com. And there you can go. There are more than 30 chants. You can listen to every one of the chants, as we used to say on the old South Side of Chicago where I grew up, free for nothing. You don't have to pay at all. And, of course, if you'd like to own a download or a CD, you can purchase one there. But otherwise, you can listen to them as long as you want for absolutely nothing. And one of those chants, for example, reminds us that God is the breath within us. The Hebrew word is ruach. It's one of those words. Ruach means breath. And so God took this lump of clay that was Adam and breathed into Adam and made Adam a living, animated human being. God breathes into us and we become living human beings. God takes away our breath and we die and return to the dust. So if we listen to our breath, mindful breathing is not just for the Buddhists. If we listen carefully to our breath, then and not concentrate even on the melody, even on the word, but concentrate on listening to our breath, we hear God within us. So the little chant goes, Ruach, 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 breathing, breathing, breathing. Chant that for 30 or 60 seconds a day. You will continually become aware of God within you.
That's lovely. I like that. Well, in you in your materials that your publicist sent, you talk a bit about prophecy, that it's not it's not over with the ancient sages. It's alive and well. Speak to that a little bit.
Well, since you're a student of Judaism, I'll tell you just a bit of the history, and that is that in biblical times, in the biblical period. Every person on earth was a possible prophet. It means that every person could see or hear or envision or dream, daydream or nightdream, dream God's word and will. And God would talk to that person or envision or dream to that person, and that person would have God's word for him or herself or give it out as a messenger. That's how Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Elijah, all of the ancient prophets, worked. At a certain point, about 2,000 years ago, beginning in about 200 before the Common Era, the sages and the scholars of the time came along and they said, biblical prophecy is over. Continuing revelation will come only through us. We're the only ones who will see and hear God. We will see and hear God. We'll get God's word. We'll call it Jewish law. We'll tell you to follow it. Because we say so. They, of course, were consolidating their power, and we've lived that way for the last 2,000 years. I posit in another book, you had Dancing with Gaia. My book, Soul Judaism, before it went to paperback, was originally called Dancing with God. So I posit in that book that just as biblical Judaism gave way to rabbinic Judaism is giving way to Judaism's third era, a new, brand new era, and since nobody named it, I got to name it. I call it Soul Judaism, which will be most characterized by the return to the possibility of biblical prophecy, that every single human being can be in that deep, personal, intimate, loving relationship with God and hear God directly through no intermediary. So
Well, that's going to get you in trouble with your colleagues who are more controlled about consolidating the power, though, isn't it?
So be it. What can I say? You know, I give this talk all over, and in the same talk, one man stood up to me, and he said, Rabbi, what you just told us is you're a visionary genius. What you've told us is going to change the world. And another woman in that same talk stood up and said, you are a blasphemer, you're going to hell.
I get
okay,
the same thing.
You know,
I get the same thing when I go out and
challenge,
talk.
Any challenge to long-held, comfortable beliefs is scary.
Well, and even your idea of the oneness consciousness, you know, that would mean, you know, we could all be under that big umbrella together instead of doing the my God or your God thing. And that's pretty scary to people who are invested in, you know, their own power, their way of teaching.
Well, I'll tell you why. What's the other end of it is more scary. And that is, and again, this is why I believe that I was given over, I don't know why me, but I was given the discovery. And I will tell you that the sages knew throughout history, and they left us hints in their writings, and I quote most of those hints in the footnotes in the back of the book. Actually, I found a couple more in my studies since I published the book, but it already has a back cover on it. I can't add to it. But they knew it just wasn't the right time. So why is this the right time? Because God is saying to us, God is saying to us, my children, I love you all. I am one God. I have one name. You can call me by different names if you want, just as in a family, somebody says daddy and somebody else says pops and somebody else says father. You can call me by different names, but stop fighting with each other and stop saying that your way of calling me or knowing me is better than anybody else's. I love you all. I don't play favorites. And I want you, since I am full love, I am total love, I love you so much, and I hope you'll love me in return. But I'm telling you, at this point, love each other, because you have found the scientific and technological ways to destroy yourselves and perish from this earth. So either you will learn to live together in harmony and tranquility and unity and peace and love, or you will destroy each other. That's why this discovery of oneness consciousness is so vital to the world at this moment in time.
Well, you're going to put the military-industrial complex out of business.
God willing.
So let me ask you. I mean, as a rabbi, I presume that, you know, spirituality has been part of your life, you know, since, you know, as long as you can remember.
No, actually not.
No?
I became a rabbi. This week, actually, is the 40th anniversary of my ordination. I've been a rabbi for 40 years. It means I was preparing for it for a decade before that. But I became a rabbi in the late 60s, early 70s, when most of my colleagues went into the rabbinate to be social justice rabbis. What we couldn't do on the streets, we were going to do through the pulpit and the establishment. I told the dean to activate my application to rabbinical school the day Bobby Kennedy was killed. So I knew I couldn't do it that way anymore.
Go ahead.
But over the years, God began revealing Godself to me more and more and more. And so the spiritual aspect of my rabbinate began to come to a fore about 20 years ago.
Okay. Well, two questions as a result of hearing that history. Number one, are you saddened that there are not more spiritual leaders out there who are fighting for social justice, you know, fighting against this greed is good mentality and, you know, this income disparity and everything that's out there in the world, this austerity that, you know, certain parties, you know, have thrust upon people, throughout the globe?
Well, I don't know, because everybody I know still fights for social justice. Jews, Christians, Muslims, everybody I know fights for social justice.
But, you know, there's no Martin Luther King. You know, there's no concerted effort. You know, there's nobody organizing, you know, millions of people in the street to march against this. You know, it just seems like it's all of these tiny little pockets. But it's not having it's not visible. Let's put it that way.
Well, look at the guests you've had. I listened to you carefully. Last week you had Matthew Fox. This week you have me. Next week you have Noam Chomsky. All of us known for our social justice our cries to social justice. And on the other hand, that great leaders don't come to the fore. It's not exactly true, because, of course, there was Martin Luther King, and there was Lech Walesa, and there was Mother Teresa in her way. And people pop up here and there. Of course, still the Dalai Lama, God bless him. But part of the nature of egalitarianism, as wonderful and as great as we think it is that people don't always turn to one leader anymore the way they used to. The charismatic leader is not embraced as much in an egalitarian world where we each have the kind of equality. So, you know, to everything there's good, there's some not so good. But if people would listen, the Matthew Foxes and the Noam Chomskys and, forgive my lack of humility, the Wayne Dotsicks of the world would come to the fore and give the teaching, give the lesson, give the cry to social justice.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So your quest, I mean, I wouldn't even have imagined that someone with your experience in vast teachings would have even considered that he needed to go on a quest to find the name of God. What set you out to look for the name of God?
Well, the first question that came to me was, how does the one perfect God have so many names? The second question that has plagued me since I was a kid, and so this goes back a long way, is, how does the one perfect God, who loves us so much, who holds us in tender compassion, who catches our tears when we weep, and who gives us this stellar set of laws to live by that elevate the human spirit and the human condition, how does this God, frankly, behave so badly in the Bible so many times? Opening the earth to swallow the enemies and decimating the faithful and bringing plagues. So eventually the answer to that, of course, is that harsh, angry God is only one aspect of God, only one of the colors of the panel beach ball. And so I, in all of this, in my prayers, I kept saying God, and I knew that Yahweh was only one aspect of God. I knew it couldn't possibly be the whole God because of such anger and such harshness. I kept saying, God, God, whatever your name is, tell me who you are. Show me the way. And so I began hearing the word Anochi over and over and over again in my prayers and meditations. And so I had the great assistance in this technological age of a biblical computer program called Accordant, and of course my distinguished colleague Rabbi Google, and I put the name into the computer, and out popped the 359 times it's used in the Bible. And because I can read the Bible in its original, I went and studied each one of those 359 times and found, as I told you earlier in the program, that it's either in the voice of God or in the voice of a human being, when the fullness of one's God self or the fullness of God must be there.
So give some examples of that, the voice of God versus the name of God being in both the voice of God and the voice of human beings.
So one is, for Jews who know this, the prayer that follows the recitation of the Declaration of Faith. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, right? This is Deuteronomy 6. Then it says, and you shall love the Lord your God, Yahweh your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words, which Anochi, I source, command you this day. So it's like saying, Anochi, I'm the CEO. I appointed Yahweh to be the COO, to be the representative of God on earth. And I am telling you, my children, follow and love and honor Yahweh the way you would follow and honor me, because Yahweh is my representative on earth right now.
So do you think you're the first one that's come across this? I mean,
well,
is
as
this...
I said, the sages throughout the history knew. I put their teachings in the footnotes in the book, but I'm the first one to articulate it in a broad way.
In contemporary time.
In the voice of a human being, God says to Cain, after Cain kills Abel, Cain, where are you? Now what, God lost Cain? There are only three people left on earth. Where, he didn't lose him. God says, contemporary language, he says, "Hey, man, where you at? What's happening? What's going on?" And Cain says, "Hashomer achi anochi. Am I my brother's guardian? Am I Anochi, my God self?" Cain didn't know the rules of Earth. He didn't know that pushing somebody or hitting him with a rock would cease him to exist. So Cain is saying, basically, do I have a responsibility for anything more than myself? Is my God self responsible for anything more than myself? Or when Rebecca was barren, she couldn't get pregnant. And, of course, in those days, the only reason for a woman to exist was to get pregnant and be a mother. So, finally, she gets pregnant. She has the twins within her, those who will become later Jacob and Esau. And they begin to fight, and they struggle with each other. And she's afraid she's going to lose the pregnancy. So she says, "Im Cain, if this is so, if I lose the pregnancy, lama ze anochi, what is my God self? What's my purpose here on earth?" Very poignant times that this word is used.
Interesting. And forgive me if this is a feeble question, but it's one that has had me wondering for a very long time, and I feel like I have the opportunity to ask it now. The conflict between the Jews and the Arabs. I mean, it goes back to. I mean, they according to the Bible, they come from the same father, do they not?
Yes.
So, I mean, so in a sense, they're, you know, historically at least, spiritually, they're brothers. I guess, you know, there's such an irony in there that, that this battle that continues to rage on is between brothers. I mean, how do they rationalize away that, that they should be family?
There is no rationalizing it away. If you take a look at Genesis, which we think is such an incredible book, in many ways it is also the history of the world's most dysfunctional family. Lies, cheating, deception, dreams unfulfilled, dreams fulfilled. It's pretty ugly, and sometimes we learn from text what not to do as well as we learn what to do. I'm not a political scientist. I don't have the answer. Each side has its own narrative, and for each narrative, there is a correctness to it and even a righteousness to it. And until we begin to understand oneness consciousness there as well, in Israel and Palestine as well, or the Palestinian territories, whatever you'd like to call them, and understand that, again, we will either learn to live together or we will destroy each other. But until we get over this notion of what your cousin Chaim did to my cousin Abdul, or your uncle Shmuel did to my cousin Ibrim in 1948 or 1967, we're at a terrible, terrible impasse. And there are separate narratives, and we have to be aware of that. And also we have to understand that it is the Middle Eastern mind. The Middle Eastern mindset does not do well with the Western mindset. The Western mindset functions one way. The Middle Eastern mindset functions with a wink and a cup of coffee. And the God love the State Department. It's never understood that.
So, but what does that mean exactly for someone that can't really translate that?
What does it mean in terms of?
Yeah. Can you explain what? I get the point that they think differently, operate differently, but but can you explain it a little bit better? Why is it they're just so culturally different or operate differently?
The Muslim world stayed mostly in the Middle East. The Jewish world moved west, 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 and so there are different ways to operate, different ways to see the world, and we just have to get people who understand that there are different mindsets, and then we can begin to talk to each other.
Okay, forgive me for pressing this. I just want to understand it better. how would you describe the different mindsets? I mean, how does the person who has the Western viewpoint, how do they see things differently than the person who stayed in the Muslim world?
The Western viewpoint usually is, I have to win. The Eastern viewpoint is, I have to save face. And I think that's very, very different. So we have to find a way here that no one wins and no one loses, but everybody saves face.
So really, so the ego is a huge, huge problem for both.
Well, so far, Bibi Netanyahu has not called me over to Jerusalem to solve the problem. So I don't know if I can be very, very helpful here. But I don't think that any president of the United States, I don't think that any secretary of state has understood this gigantic difference. The person who came closest was Clinton. And, and I don't know what to say. At Camp David, the Israelis offered 96.4% of what Yasser Arafat requested, and he turned it down. And at the same time, my wife and I happened to be in Jerusalem that summer as Camp David was breaking down, and we saw pictures of Arafat's folks training teenagers in summer camps to be terrorists, 25,000 kids in a summer camp. So I just don't know. And as I say, I'm not a political scientist. I don't know how to really solve this problem. I just know that everything that's been tried so far hasn't worked.
I understand. Well, and it what you described sort of reminds me of our own Congress. You know, Obama gives Republicans, Republican ideas, and they still reject it. You know, he supports their policies, and then suddenly because he's for them, they're against them. So I guess it's a little bit all over the place, but the oneness consciousness, the wisdom, the beauty that is part of your teachings in the real name of God, for listeners who would say, how do we go out there and teach this? I mean, what would you say to them? How can they spread that idea? Is it taking hold? Or are you seeing it take hold out there? What's the reaction been?
Karen, it's taking hold like this. As I mentioned earlier, I grew up in the southeast side of Chicago. 1945, it was a Polish Catholic steelworkers neighborhood. In 1960, it was a half-Jewish neighborhood. In 1970, it was a completely black neighborhood. Same middle-class homes, but different ethnic and racial backgrounds. And when in the late 40s, early 50s, we all played together on the playground. And then when we got to kindergarten, I went to public school. Some of my friends went to the local parochial school, St. Mary Magdalene's. By the time I was 8, 9, 10, I was being beaten up on a regular basis by my former friends who had learned from their priests and their nuns that I, Wayne Dossick, had personally killed their Lord. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a number of decades. I'm a rabbi on a faculty of a Catholic university, teaching the only courses in Jewish studies in the Department of Religion, working with the Monsignor for Ministry and Ministry to create a yearly all-faith service where clergy of all different faiths come to the church on campus and pray each in his or her own language, her own faith tradition. I myself preach from the pulpit of the Immaculata, standing next to a statue of Jesus. And as I mentioned, one of my closest friends in the entire world is a Jesuit priest. Why did this all happen? Most of it because of a twinkle-eyed pope named John the 23rd, who changed the world, who literally changed the world. 50 years after 2,000 years of enmity between Christians and Jews, 50 years is all it took for a rabbi to teach on a faculty of a Catholic university and a priest to come to a Passover Seder and not accuse the rabbi of blood libel. I mean, amazing. Just amazing. And so it can happen. Remember 1987, we had the harmonic convergence? And they said,
yeah.
Oh, you foolish children, singing and holding hands, thinking you're going to change the world. Well, if in 1986 I had told you that in 20 years the Berlin Wall would fall, communism would fall in the Soviet Union, all the satellite countries would become democratic, blacks and whites would ride the bus together in South Africa, Protestants and Catholics would stop shooting each other in Northern Ireland, and once in a while Israelis and Palestinians would sit down at a peace table, you'd tell me I'm crazy. But we sent a certain energy out to the world. We sent a certain energy out to the world.
I guess we forget the progress we've made as we feel mired in the muck of today's problems. But you do. You remind us that we have made great strides.
Great strides. And, we Jews have a prayer for peace. We have three formal services a day, three times a day for the last 2,000 years. We've been praying for peace. So somebody said to me, what fools you are. You've been praying for peace all this time, three times a day, 7 days a week, 2,000 years, and still there's no peace. I said to him, it's really very simple. If every person on the face of this earth prayed for peace at the exact same moment, for that moment at least, we'd have peace. And then we could extend it to the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment. And if we have peace in this moment or that moment, I can't shoot a gun at you, nor can I cheat you in business, because God is right before us, and God is the one whose godness we cannot dare diminish any longer.
Well, Rabbi Dasik, thank you for being on the show. In the real name of God, Anoki, right?
Anoki. Anoki is the stuff you eat in a good Italian restaurant.
I know. Okay. I'm going to have to practice
Anoki.
It. I'm going to have to practice it. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
Before you say goodnight, please go ahead and tell listeners where they can get your book and your website.
Thank you. Books are in bookstores. They're also at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. The website is www.godisanochi.com. There you can get a first edition autographed copy of the book. You can listen to all the chants. You can buy the chants if you want them. You can buy the companion booklet, The Care and Feeding of Your God Self. There's an Anochi poster over which you can use meditation. And if you can't remember, godisanochi.com, check out Rabbi, R-A-B-B-I, Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, Dasik, D-O-S-I-C-K.com. There are links all over. And if you really, really want to find me and can't find me, I'm at wdosick, W-D-O-S-I-C-K, at Gmail, or go to Google Docs and put in your name, and I'll be able to get in touch with you.
Lots of ways to reach you. And you're available to give talks and workshops. And you're
I go anywhere that people will listen. I do complete scholar-in-residence weekends at synagogues and churches. I do full 2.5-day workshops on the care and feeding of your God self. I do individual lectures. I do two-three-hour workshops. Anywhere that people will listen to this idea and give it a fair and good hearing, because I guarantee you when you do, you will have an aha moment, and you will say, this solves so many of the contradictions and the paradoxes and the mysteries that have bothered me all this time. And then you can join me, because I invite you to come to Sinai once again to discover the real name of God and to meet God face to face.
Well, thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Your time tonight, and good luck with your oneness consciousness. The world certainly needs it.
Well, you are certainly one of the people who is deeply, deeply involved, so I thank you for caring about these ideas, and I thank you for bringing the feminine to the fore, because until the masculine and the feminine, both the divine masculine and feminine and on earth, braid together, we will not have this oneness consciousness. We need the masculine and the feminine as one once again in order to move this world into Eden on earth once again.
Amen. Hallelujah. Or Ashi, as some of my women friends would say.
There
well,
you
good
go.
Night, Rabbi. And,
good night.
And
thank you very
good
much.
Luck with your book. Good luck
Thanks.
With your book.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was a fun conversation. I'm sure you enjoyed it as much as I did. But I see Father Roy Bourgeois is on the switchboard, and I'm going to unmute him and say hello. Hello, Father Bourgeois. How are you? Hello? Oh, wait, let me see, maybe. Oh, I unmuted the wrong one. Okay. Father, give me a minute here. Father Roy, are you there?
Yes, yes, it's good to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. For some of my listeners who might not know of you yet, with your permission, I think I'd like to start our interview tonight by reading your statement about your dismissal from Mary Knoll that you wrote last November. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Okay. These are the words of Father Roy Bourgeois. I've been a Catholic priest in the Mary Knoll community for 40 years. As a young man, I joined Mary Knoll because of its work for justice and equality in the world. To be expelled from Mary Knoll and the priesthood for believing that women are also called to be priests is very difficult and painful. The Vatican and Mary Knoll can dismiss me, but they cannot dismiss the issue of gender equality in the Catholic Church. The demand for gender equality is rooted in justice and dignity and will not go away. As Catholics, we profess that God created men and women of equal worth and dignity. As priests, we profess that the call to the priesthood comes from God, only God. Then who are we as men to say that our call from God is authentic, but God's call to women is not? The exclusion of women from the priesthood is a grave injustice against women, our church, and our loving God, who calls both men and women to be priests. When there is an injustice, silence is the voice of complicity. My conscience compelled me to break my silence and address the sin of sexism in my church. My only regret is that it took me so long to confront the issue of male power and domination in the Catholic Church. I've explained my position on the ordination of women and how I came to it in my booklet called My Journey from Silence to Solidarity, which listeners can find at roybourgeoisjourney.org. roybourgeoisjourney.org. Couldn't have said it more succinctly, and I thank you for being the hero that you are, Father Bourgeois.
Well, you know, that letter, you know, it was written November the 19th, so it's been a few months now, and, you know, like most people who go through hard times, I'm bouncing back, but it's still, you know, disappointing, you know, that there wasn't the support from my community and, of course, from the Vatican. I tried my best to explain my position over the last 3 years. 3 years ago, first let me just backtrack a little bit. About really 10 years ago, I really started to break my silence as I began to meet many devout Catholic women in the church who shared with me their call to the priesthood. And I regret to say that in the seminary and throughout my priesthood, we never talked about why women couldn't be priests. Whenever the discussion came up, it was always, well, it's our tradition. And after meeting all these devout Catholic women, I felt that I really had to think this through. And what I just asked some basic questions. I mean, why wouldn't women be priests? Don't we profess as Catholics that we created of equal worth and dignity, men and women, in the image of God? And the big one, though, was as Catholic priests, we all say that the call to be a priest comes from God. And the question I began to ask myself and my fellow priest, you know, again, who are we to say our call is authentic, but God's call of women is not? And that's when I really began to see this grave injustice and quite surprised to see the reaction of so many of my fellow priests. I didn't realize, Karen, how deep, perhaps I was naive simply because we didn't talk about this for years, but how deep the sexism really was in my church. And what helped me to go through that process of seeing that sin of sexism was growing up in this small town in Louisiana, in a, you know, a little town where the majority were Catholic. We're talking about the 50s, 60s, but I went to, you know, a segregated high school for 12 years. And worshipped in the Catholic Church, where the last five pews were reserved for the black members. And I look back, and I could not remember a teacher, a parent, a priest, a student, including myself, whoever said, we have a problem here. This is racism. This is a sin. This is wrong. What I do remember so well were the mantras, this is our tradition, this segregation. Mm-hmm. Separated, you know, separate schools and separate, even the church segregated. What I do remember also is that, you know, the mantra separate but equal. And what I was hearing in my church from the Vatican was very similar language. to support sexism. This is our tradition in the church, an all-male priesthood, and men and women are equal, but we have different roles. And what I saw, of course, was this sin of sexism, and what I began to say was sexism, like racism, and homophobia. This is immoral. It's prejudice. It's discrimination against others. And no matter how hard we may try to justify discrimination against others, in the end, it is never the way of a loving God who created us equally. And so
well,
when
you
I broke my silence, I really started to get in trouble.
Well, you know, I don't know if we spoke about this, but, you know, I'm from New Orleans. And I remember growing up in that, you know, in that Catholic bubble. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so many people just, you know, it never challenged what was normal. You know, you just never heard any sort of discussion. It was all just taken as, quote, gospel. And there just wasn't a lot of critical thinking going on. You know, it was a lot of groupthink. And but I wonder now, Father Bourgeois, now that you've had so much time to think about it, what's behind the excuse? I mean, is it just sheer effort to consolidate power, or is there some irrational, unconscious fear of women? I mean, what could justify this, this horrible injustice?
Well, I've given this a lot of thought, what you're asking. I mean, I was quite shocked at some of the responses from priest friends I've known for years who worked on issues of justice. I've been very involved in peace and justice work, including many years of work in what we call the School of the Americas issue, having worked, and when I was ordained, I was sent to Bolivia to work with the poor. And that became my home for 5 years, where I became very involved in working with the poor and the oppressed of Latin America, and became very involved later in El Salvador. And we've been trying to shut down this, you know, a school that trains soldiers every year from Latin America, and our movement has grown from a small group to thousands. And so, and many priests in Marino and Jesuits and others have been very involved in this justice issue and other issues of justice. But when it came to the issue of women being ordained, what I saw was really something that was very, very disappointing. Somehow women were seen as a threat to our power, that somehow there was this fear of women. And what it came down to, which is very clear, is that, you know, this all-male clerical culture over the centuries have built up, amassed a lot of power. It's an all-male clerical culture, really, that sees women as a threat to our power, and who would see women as somehow lesser than men. And what, you know, what I see, though, I mean, to really keep peeling that onion back and getting at the core of the problem is this, I think, and I've given this a lot of thought. We, you know, in Louisiana, New Orleans, in that little town I lived in, Lutcher, Louisiana, you know, we created in a way. I mean, we all say that we, as people of faith, are created in the image of God. But what we often do, and I see the Vatican doing this, that we so often create God in our image. Our God in Louisiana, you know, that we worship, there was, I remember the statue in this little church, there was a, you know, Mary was white, and there was a little baby Jesus who was white with blonde curly hair.
I remember that, yes, yes.
I mean, we worship this white God that
with blonde hair.
Yeah, yes, and that somehow saw people of color as somehow lesser than us.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see really, and this is serious, I see men at the Vatican, church leaders, priests, bishops, popes in the past, what we have done, we have created God in our image. And this God that we worship, that we create, is not this all-loving, all-powerful God, you know, but it's this male God, often very white, who would see women as somehow lesser than men. And I'll go a step further. The coolest of all teachings in the Catholic Church is this teaching on homosexuality. What I see so often now is how the Vatican, the hierarchy, the patriarchy of the Church, is presenting this not only a male God, but a God who is straight.
Right.
Who views, you know, our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters somehow as lesser than you know, those who claim ownership of the Church. And what we have here really is the core of the crisis in the Catholic Church. I travel a lot. I give talks all over the country, and I meet so many of our young members of the Catholic Church who say to me, the vast majority, I cannot be a member of this church. It's anti-women, anti-gay. And I hear from many of their parents who raise their children Catholic, send them to these expensive, you know, high school, Catholic high schools and colleges, and they'll come home from college and they say, you know, Mom, I cannot pretend anymore. I am not welcome in this church. I'm a woman, or I'm, you know, lesbian, I'm gay. I do not feel welcome. And what we have now, you know, Catholics, especially our youth and many others, are much more educated. I grew up at a time in Louisiana, you know, in the Catholic Church, when it was yes, Father, no,
mm-hmm.
Father.
Mm-hmm.
But those days are gone. And I think what the core of the crisis is the image of God that the Vatican is presenting to the Catholic Church is not the God that most people worship. The God that most people worship, especially our youth, is a very, very loving God. Out in Lansing, Pennsylvania, just last week, this college student put it this way. You know, at the end of the day, you know, no matter how much I mess up, the God that I believe in loves me, you know, understands,
yeah.
And is with me. And that's not the God that the Vatican is presenting to the faithful, and therein lies the problem.
Well, when you think about the gay kids who feel like they're an abomination, I mean, some of them have even committed suicide. I mean, it's really egregious, you know, this man-made dogma that's, you know, so divisive and hateful. Can it be lost on the Vatican that they will not excommunicate a priest who is known to be a child molester, but they will excommunicate a priest who believes in equality and justice? I mean, it's insane, really.
Now, when I first heard from the Vatican 3 years ago, because I actually even attended the ordination of one of the many women being ordained, but I did receive, because of being outspoken now, really went public in many of my talks and sermons, spoke openly about the ordination of women. And so 3 years ago, I received a letter from the Vatican saying that I was causing grave scandal in the Catholic Church, and I had 30 days to recant my public support for the ordination of women, or I would be excommunicated. I wrote back and really put a lot of work in that response, and I focused in on the issue of conscience. You know, our conscience, as we've always been taught as Catholics and other faith traditions, it's very sacred. It's our lifeline to the divine. You know, our conscience urges us always to do what is right, what is just. And I said, what you are asking me, telling me to do, would be a betrayal of my conscience. It would be a lie, and this I cannot do. And I also included in my response their use of the words causing grave scandal. And I said, you know, when Catholics hear the word scandal, they don't think of the ordination of women, but rather, and I used the New York Times statistics at that time, and the United States alone, over 5,000 Catholic priests sexually abused over 12,000 children. And they, of course, were not excommunicated, and nor were their bishops and many cardinals who covered up their horrific crimes. They were not excommunicated or expelled from the church. And the majority of them, of course, are continuing on in their ministry. And I never received a response back from the, you know, from the Vatican when about my work. But here's something else that the point you brought up. I think the cruelest of all of the church teachings is its teaching on homosexuality. I would encourage our listeners to get what's called the New Catechism of the Catholic Church, second edition, that was really promoted by Pope John Paul, the last pope before Benedict. And just go into section 2357 through 59, and on homosexuality, and it's embarrassing. It's very difficult to even talk about this on the phone, but it's a, what they say here, homosexuality is referred to as an objective disorder, in their quotes. And any homosexual acts are referred to as a grave depravity. And the solution, of course, that they're giving to those who are homosexuals is a lifetime of celibacy. And what's very upsetting to me personally, as a Catholic priest for 40 years, I had many gay friends in Marino and the Jesuits, Franciscans, and many other, the orders. And many priests are gay, and many have their gay partners and are very, sexual. And it's this hypocrisy. And we know at the Vatican, for example, there are many gay bishops and cardinals, and popes of the past have been gay. But what has to happen, I believe, really? And what's so disappointing, though, is that a lot of priests are simply afraid to come out and support the ordination of women, or to talk about this church teaching on homosexuality. That is cruel, that is hateful, that has nothing to do with God, and that it must be changed. It's to break the silence. And that's why I'm encouraging wherever I speak, and those who are listening, if they have not spoken out on these issues and are connected to a faith community, especially if they are Catholic, to please, please break your silence and speak out about this grave injustice against these church teachings that, as you mentioned, really, and this is serious, I met just not long ago in Baltimore, this couple whose son in high school committed suicide, gay, who was so shamed into believing that somehow he wasn't worthy. But the Catholic Church, I believe, is complicit in that young person's death.
Absolutely.
And should be brought to trial. I mean, this is serious stuff.
Well,
and
we
have to break our silence, because silence, especially on these issues of prejudice and discrimination that causes so much suffering among women and the gay community, that our silence is that voice of complicity.
Well, it also bugs me too, Father Roy, that, the church is silent about a lot of important things. Francis now has started to talk about the culture of greed. But, what about social welfare? What about poverty? It doesn't seem like these things are their concern anymore. You see these bishops and the pope who lives in opulence, telling everybody else the way they should live their life, passing down this man-made dogma that, just hurts people and creates divisiveness. And for heaven's sake, we have to have a law against, gay bashing, because people think that, they have a right to do things like that because the Bible tells them so, kind of a thing. It's it's unconscionable, really. You know, when we think about, you know, maybe in a way the church is making itself irrelevant because it's not really front and center, you know, in integrity, in relevance anymore. I don't know. Do you feel the same way? I mean, I just asked for Rabbi Dossip, you know, where are our spiritual leaders? You know, of course, you've spoken out, but like, where are the, you know, we need 25, 30, 100 Martin Luther Kings, you know, marching in the street, grassroots movements. I guess there's so much injustice, whether we're talking about women or gays or poverty. We have to attack it from so many different angles to right the wrongs. Maybe it just feels overwhelming.
Well, yes, but I must say I'm looking for hope, as we all are, but I see so little hope, you know, from priests, from the hierarchy, the patriarchy. It reminds me of, you know, my years spent in Latin America, you know, living under dictators like General Banzer in Bolivia. What I learned there was that change will never come from the top down, but rather from the poor, from the oppressed, from the poor. And that's the way it worked in Latin America. And I think that's the way it will have to work in the Catholic Church. I don't see much hope in this new Pope, Pope Francis, or the hierarchy, the patriarchy. We have lost our way. We have become addicted to power. I mean, just look at Pope Benedict. You know, so many of my friends said, you know, what's with this, all of this gold and, you know, the fur and the red shoes? I mean, what, like Maureen Dowd would say, you know, it's these costumes that remind other people that somehow you're above them.
Mm-hmm.
But what's very important, I think, though, is to realize that change will not come from those who abuse their power. Today we hear, I mean, I really hate to be so critical of the Catholic Church, and I have often thought, like so many of my friends and so many who have left the church, you know, and just say, I'm out of here. And so many women and, of course, members of the gay community have done just that. They couldn't take it anymore. I have chosen, even being expelled from the priesthood, to stay in the Catholic Church and to work with many, you know, the women priests. There's a big movement in the country and throughout the world, the women's ordination movement, who are not leaving. And they said, I'm Catholic. I will not allow these, you know, these old men in Rome to claim ownership of the church and continue to bully the church as they're doing, abuse their power. And that's why I'm staying in as long as I can to work for reform, to simply say to priests that I know and bishops here in the United States and those at the Vatican, we will not allow you to beat up on people and to abuse your power as you're doing. No, this is our church. You are not the owners of the church. And a big issue, of course, will be the, you know, it's coming to a head, the you know, the, 2 years ago, the Vatican wrote the Catholic nuns, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, some 58,000 nuns, reminding them that they are the bosses, you know, that they are superior. In the letter they said, we, men at the Vatican, are the authentic teachers of faith and morals, and saying to the nuns that you must obey us. We are the leaders. We are your superiors. And I just hope, you know, that there's so much love for the nuns, as we know, that I just hope that these nuns will simply say to those at the Vatican, you know, you are not our bosses. We are equal. God does not just speak through you. And not only you can interpret the Holy Scriptures, as you're saying. We are the church, and God speaks through all of us, and we are equal. But I would like for him, again, more and more people to join in with, you know, with the nuns, the women religious, and to simply speak with them on their behalf, to walk in solidarity with the nuns, with the women, with, you know, the LGBT community, and just say, no, this is our church, and we have a voice.
Well, I've often said, you know, we are, you know, there are more of us than there are of them.
That's you know, exactly.
You know, exactly. Quite frankly. I'd like you to tell listeners, what has this excommunication meant to your life, to your well-being, to your retirement, you know, and also, if the nuns stand up to the Vatican and say, you're not going to be the boss of me, you know, I'm doing God's work, Jesus's work, what can the Vatican do them? You know, would there be any repercussion, or can the Vatican really touch them?
That's what I've been asking. In fact, I was just on a delegation to U.S.-Mexico border looking into the whole issues of immigration that's so important now. But on the delegation that was sponsored by our SOA Watch movement were four nuns, and we had many conversations during the week exactly about what you're talking about. What are the consequences if they say no to these bullies at the Vatican? And there is some concern that they actually, their property could be confiscated by the Vatican or their local bishops. But again, I think they have so much support and love from so many people who have been educated by nuns that they will not, I mean, they're picking on the wrong group here.
Right.
But let me say, being more personal, I must say I'm still recovering. I mean, friends have said, well, it's like going through a painful divorce. I notice it's been, 5 months now? And, I mean, there are some real rough days. I feel a real sadness. I feel hurt, a lot of pain, especially from longtime friends who simply just, you know, we've been friends for so long, fellow priests. They're just upset with me. They somehow believe that they're very angry that I somehow broke this very, very serious rule in the all boys club. I wanted to invite women in as equals. And that was very, very upsetting to them. And they have not forgotten it. And they are letting me know. I mean, they just ended the friendship right there. And then some are saying, how can you possibly do this to our Merino community? And so I don't know what to do, but let me say in the midst of my sadness, what's happening, I'm sort of for the first time getting a glimpse of what women and members from our gay community really do who have experienced such rejection for centuries. And what I'm experiencing is but a glimpse of that. And it just reminds me, though, that when you do take a stand, I mean, I knew what I was getting into. I knew this could happen because of the warnings I got from the Vatican, you know, from my own superior of Merino. They warned me for 3 years. And I knew the day could come, and it did come. And it hurts very deeply, but at the same time, I'm filled with hope, Karen, because I've done a lot of reflecting. In Louisiana, in the South, you know, there were many who tried to stop the abolition of slavery, including many in the church. Mm-hmm. There were many who tried to stop the right of women to vote. They failed. And there are many who tried to stop the civil rights movement. They, too, failed. And on this issue of women's ordination and same-sex marriage, they will also fail because these movements are rooted in justice. It's rooted in dignity and in justice. And these movements, I think, are of the divine. They're of a God. And that movement rooted in justice, dignity, and equality simply is unstoppable. And
yeah.
What was seen as impossible, you know, in the past, today is inevitable. So I know, I mean, I'm filled with a lot of hope because in my travels, I meet people, a lot of people, who give me hope on both of these issues, women's ordination, same-sex marriage, especially that movement, the support for it is much greater. And the Catholic Church for women's ordination, we're talking about 70%. And about the same for same-sex marriage of Catholics, you know. But in the country, 35 and younger, it's like 84%.
Yeah, I mean,
and
it's just a no-brainer. Yeah,
that gives me great hope.
Yeah, yeah. It, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, this could all just be. People will say, "You mean that? You mean they didn't always ordain women?"
We're going to look back on these, you know, these movies like. As we do now when I go home to visit family, when we saw together last year, was it that movie, The Help? You know, it was with my siblings, you know, we went to see it together, and we said, you know, how could we have been so silent, you know, during those days of segregation? I mean, why didn't someone yell out, there's a problem here? It's called racism. And my brother just said, kind of, you know, well, that, you know, it was seen as normal. It was just like the way it was. And today, though, we look back and say, how could we have been so ignorant, so cruel, so racist? And that's the response we are going to have real soon when it comes to the ordination of women.
Well, you know, on the subject of racism, I think, you know, it wasn't that long ago we would not have ever imagined a black president. But yet look at the incredible backlash. You know, I honestly, in my heart, I think all of the Republican obstructionism is all rooted in racism. But just last week I had Matthew Fox on the show, and he was talking about how the Vatican was working with Reagan and the CIA to thwart liberation theology down in Latin America, you know.
I saw that in Bolivia.
Yeah, and so when you see, you know, and the more people know, you know, and you know, people like you coming on the show and you know, all of my other wonderful guests, I mean, they reach a new audience to share this information, because obviously, you know, it's like the Vatican is invested not in, you know, teaching the words of Jesus, but they seem to just be invested in squashing any kind of, you know, critical thinking, any kind of, liberation theology would have put some power in the hands of the people rather just in their hands, would it not?
Yeah, exactly. Now, what we're talking about is so important. I mean, I really do realize I'm carrying a lot of anger right now, and as I did when I came back from Bolivia. I mean, just to see what our country was doing there, and later in El Salvador, you know, the assassination of Bishop Romero, the rape and murder of four church women, two of them Merino nuns who were friends. But when I came back from El Salvador, I was filled with a lot of anger.
But
I realized
it's righteous,
that I had,
it's righteous anger, Father.
That, you know, where I had to, you know, not allow the anger to consume me, but to direct it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way. So that's when I, you know, started protesting, went to prison for a couple of years, and it was all in the name of solidarity, which I learned in El Salvador and Bolivia. It's all about, you know, solidarity simply means to accompany, to walk with, to make the struggle of others your struggle, the struggle for justice. And that's what I'm trying to do, you know, with the women's ordination movement, and also the you know, the gay rights movement, that where the Catholic Church really is causing such harm, such suffering, that I feel, you know, there's anger there, but I'm going to direct it in a good way. I'm not leaving. I'm inviting, you know, more people to stay in the church and say, look, let's, you know, reclaim the church.
Right.
Let those bullies who are trying to say they own the church, let them know this is our church, and we will change these teachings that cause all of this prejudice and suffering to others. I think it can be done.
Well, and, you know, think of this, honestly. I mean, if the people with the courage to stay in can thwart the bullies, imagine the pulpit that they have there. I mean, they can fight injustice. They can fight out against war. You know, put the military-industrial complex out of business. You know, I mean, they could make greed taboo. I mean, greed used to be one of the seven deadly sins, you know. I mean, there's such a pulpit there to change the world for the many instead of the few. And honestly, I know you don't want to be angry, but how can anybody in good conscience not be angry at all the injustice, all the income disparity, all the suffering, you know, in the world? There's a lot to be angry about.
I hear you. And actually, as we know, anger can be a real force for good. I mean, how can we not be angry at what our foreign policy is doing on the border? You know, we just came back from Nogales, Mexico, to talk with, you know, the migrants there, women who have been, you know, physically removed from their children because they didn't have the right papers, yet their children were born in the U.S., but they are now separated. And the many who are trying to cross the border because of the violence and poverty. But our foreign policy, domestic policies, and of course now the church policies. And it's not just the Catholic Church. There are other faith communities, faith traditions, I know, who have these same teachings that really discriminate, that cause this untold suffering. Now, one thing I just want to recommend, too, is there's a great documentary, the first ever documentary on the women's ordination movement. It's called Pink Smoke Over the Vatican. I love the title. It's well done. It's received a number of awards, and I travel with it whenever I, in my many talks. It's called Pink Smoke Over the Vatican. It's available on Amazon.com. And that little booklet that actually you mentioned, our website, and there's a booklet that we've just released. It's My Journey from Silence to Solidarity, and that can be obtained by going to our website, www.roybourgeoisjourney.org. But those are two good resources, I think, that can help sort of, you know, empower us. It's my own sharing in a very personal way, you know, leaving Louisiana, you know, after college in Lafayette, Louisiana, and then going into the military of Vietnam for a year, where that became a turning point, and then feeling that call to the priesthood, and then going to Latin America for some years, and then coming home and being introduced to this injustice much closer to home in my church.
Yeah.
The exclusion of women to be ordained, and why I became involved, and really why I could not say to the Vatican, I recant. I couldn't do that.
So before I let you go, Father Roy, you mentioned you don't think things are going to be too much different with our new Pope, Pope Francis. Has he, has there been any indicators yet? Or is it just his history? I mean, what makes you, because, you know, it was this, all of this talk about he's chosen the name of Francis, maybe he's going to care about the poor. I know he gave a talk about the culture of greed. Do you think is that just smoke and mirrors? Are they throwing out crumbs, to just sort of pacify people? Has he taken a stand on the nuns, or I'm just wondering your thoughts on Francis.
Well, I, like so many, you know, I'm hoping for the best. But there was just a little, you know, a message that came from the Vatican. It was that just over a week ago that he has affirmed the indictment, in a sense, against the nuns that I was really hoping. But that has to be clarified also. Did it come actually from Pope Francis or from one of the cardinals?
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, supports Pope Benedict, where that indictment really came from, the investigation and the reprimand of the nuns. It doesn't look too good. But what I've learned, I mean, change will not come from one person, from the Pope,
right,
from the president, from anybody in power. And with the problem with the Catholic Church, I mean, these bishops, the hierarchy, those at the Vatican, are hand-picked. I mean, if there was anything in their record, in their past, that showed they did not agree with the Church's teaching on women and homosexuality, they would not have been chosen for to be a bishop or a cardinal or the pope. And so what we've got, I think, is, you know, an all-boys club who will continue to see women, even with the new pope, as a threat to their power.
So what do the people on the inside, you know, you say change comes not from the top, and I get that. I mean, I think a lot of us really realized that when we put all of our hope in President Obama, and then we saw that he couldn't, you know, he couldn't do what we thought he was going to do.
I was saying, like everybody else, yes, we can, yes, we can.
Yeah.
And I'm so, I mean, really, all one has to do is simply take a few days and go to the U.S.-Mexico border, El Paso, or Nogales, and just see. You know, President Obama has, you know, has deported three times more people than Bush did.
Yeah.
I mean, the cruelty of that. But I do believe, though, again, though, that, you know, we're not alone. I mean, I'm filled with a lot of hope because I see a movement in the country, but it's coming from the grassroots. You know, it's coming from people who are, for the first time, discovering their voices. Even when I go home, I find my nieces and nephews are saying things. I mean, when I was their age, I was not questioned. I wasn't speaking out. They become, you know, very critical of the church, of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we have to start, is start to, you know, look at issues with critical eyes.
Right.
And really start, again, breaking our silence and being participants in the world simply rather than just followers.
Absolutely. We don't have, well, sheeple, we like to call them here.
That's it. Exactly.
You know, no need for sheeple. We need some courageous social justice activists out there.
Yeah, and we cannot wait for the church leaders, all the government leaders. I mean, really, our church leaders have become, you know, corporate executives. They have become government sheep in a sense, and
right.
We are the ones who have to really start taking leadership roles.
Well, Father Roy, I just want to thank you for your courage. I know it cost you a lot personally, emotionally, but, you know, you are going to be standing on the right side of history, and, you know, you will be remembered for doing the right thing, and you are beloved, and you are a hero to so many of us. So I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you, Karen. I hope, you know, to see you one day, but keep up all your great work there at the station.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And, you know, as things change, please feel free to come back on anytime if there's any new news you want to share with listeners.
You bet. Look forward to it.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Well, listeners, sometimes we talk about heavy topics here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And I thought to lighten things up a bit, I'd play this funny little song from one of our new artists. Her name is Celia from her Naughty and Pink album. So after we listen to that for a little bit, please come back. I have some announcements that I'd like to share with you. But first, let me find this from Celia. Let's see. This one is called The Yum Yum Song.
Yum Yum. Yum yum, yum yum.
One, two, ready, yum.
Yum yum, yum yum, yum yum, yum yum.
Do you remember me like I remember you from a lifetime long ago? I know you do.
Yeah.
We were once both
yeah.
Connoisseurs.
Yeah.
I think you saw.
Just we laughed and commented how times had changed. The newly commissioned life-size and seated statue of Sekhmet, nearly 9 feet tall if standing, was traveling not by her more ancient traditional means along the waterways of the Nile aboard a golden bark, but instead along contemporary highways of asphalt and concrete in a padded SUV. Her official procession consisted of several cars of male and female clergy who were on hand to help and witness this important occasion. We imagined all the cars following behind us along the route, a part of her sacred entourage. And the 3 hours it took to make the journey to her temporary home, the Goddess Temple of Orange County, I remember contemplating Sekhmet's story and why I believe she is a vital goddess today's women and men should benefit from knowing, as we must find strength, tenacity, and courage in ourselves and save the world. You know, there's not the plethora of information out there on Sekhmet, the lion-headed Egyptian goddess, as one might find on other goddesses, even Egyptian goddesses, and this knowledge gap sometimes leaves her misunderstood by curious contemporaries, understanding little of Sekhmet beyond her reputation that associates her with the dangerous heat of the desert and the myth where she would have destroyed humanity had she not been tricked into drinking a sleeping potion. To the casual observer, she was danger and destruction personified, as she was thought to be the bringer of plagues and might be looked upon as a mercenary of sorts for her father, Ra, the sun god. No wonder people of earlier times, as well as today, might approach Sekhmet with extreme caution until they find courage to lift her red linen veil and become more acquainted with who I've come to call the Lady of Tenacity Manifested. Sekhmet, whose name is derived from Sekhem, means power, but the whole story will soon unfold to tell she is the power so much in demand today, particularly as an archetype of female empowerment. You can learn more about this great solar creatrix who created humankind with her tears at the Grand Consecration of Sekhmet, held at the Goddess Temple of Orange County's Summer Solstice Ritual on Saturday, June 22nd from 6:30 to 9:30. At this very special evening event, there will be ancient recitation, performances, poetry, and dance. Many people are flying in from all over to witness the greatest change the temple has seen since its inception 10 years ago. Bear witness as the temple unveils the new, huge Sekhmet statue on loan from the collection of Reverend Roy and Karen Tate on her step pyramid, being constructed now in a warehouse in Fullerton by a design team as the center point of the sanctuary. If you're in Southern California, or even if you're within driving distance, don't miss this. Reservations are very limited. If you'd like to RSVP, call the Goddess Temple at 949-651-0564. And if you couldn't write that down fast enough, just email me and I'll put you in touch with the right people to make sure you get a reservation. Yes, most definitely, it is that energy of Sekhmet, that Lady of Tenacity Manifested, that we need so much. We talk about it a lot here. We talk about women changing the world with our like-minded brothers, how we have to be like water wearing away rock. Well, Sekhmet is the goddess archetype that helps us become that courageous warrior or warrioress. Also coming up in Southern California, in Long Beach on June 15th, you won't want to miss the Summer Solstice Fair at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 5450 Atherton in Long Beach. It's only $5 to get in, and you get a raffle ticket and lots of wonderful performers throughout the day, as many as great food and vendors and hourly raffles. I'm going to actually have a table there. If you're going to be there at Long Beach Woman Spirit, please look for me. Come by and say hello. Also, save the date. because coming September 6th, 7th, and 8th is the first annual Goddess Spirit Rising Conference, an international retreat on the Pacific in Malibu, California. The organizers say join them for three amazing days of workshops, ceremony, and wisdom with world-renowned presenters, plus artists, musicians, vendors, readers, and healers. As reflections of her divinity, we invite you to be part of the celebration of her and the creation of a vision for a world that reflects her more closely. We seek to honor our diversity, the beauty of her children, and our collective contributions in a world built on community, mutuality, and reverence for she who is all. For more information about that September 6th, 7th, and 8th conference, go to goddessspiritrising.com. And also save the date, October 6th is the Pagan Pride Day at Rainbow Lagoon Park in Long Beach. The Pagan Pride folks said they received a lot of positive feedback regarding their new location there at the Rainbow Lagoon in Long Beach when they headed there last year, so they're back there again with workshops, entertainment, rituals, authors, and sacred shopping. What could be better? I'll actually be there, too, as I will be at the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference giving a talk. I'll be talking on Sekhmet at the Pagan Pride Day, and I'll be talking about social justice activism at the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference. So I want to thank you listeners for tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoy both of my guests. And to close tonight's show, I am going to pay tribute to Sekhmet because we've been talking about her and talking about the need for her energy. But I also want to just remind you how important it is to find your sacred roar. And next week, I hope you'll tune in with me. I will have Noam Chomsky on the show. And Lane Redman is my second guest next week. You'll want to hear more about the new Bee Priestess class that she will be teaching very soon online, and you can be a part of that. So let me just find this Sekhmet music here to close off tonight's show. It's called Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride. Good night, listeners. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Thank you for all your wonderful feedback, and go out there and find your sacred roar. Good night until next week.
Wonder visions in the wasteland. Home segment.